of A Marriage of Hartwig.
Nobody looks at those next.
Mr. Wimmershoff?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Nick Wimmershoff, 9538, for the appellate.
You may begin.
Your Honors, I ask for this opportunity for oral argument because I feel there's an extremely important issue that hasn't been addressed in Colorado before, which is essentially the tension between the CFI statute and the evaluator statute. Our position is that the facts in this case left open a big question as to who's qualified to render opinions with regard to the endangerment standard. In our view, it takes a qualified professional expert witness under 702 to render that type of a decision. And the reason is that when you're making a recommendation on the endangerment statute, it incorporates concepts of child development, emotional status of the child, maybe even a psychological evaluation of the child, and maybe one or both of the parents, in order to determine whether or not it's beneficial for the child to be rooted out of the residence that the child has been in a substantial amount of time, in this case 8 years, and transported to another location 900 miles away, which it isn't the same as Hatton, but it's close. It's removing the child substantially from contact with the mother. The other issues in this case that were not addressed by the CFI had to do with an analysis of the home situation in Iowa, an analysis of the conflictual relationship between the father and the mother in this case, which by virtue of this litigation exacerbated and became more and more of an issue than it was prior to the CFI's recommendations, and the no examination of the child's relationship with the mother, what actually caused the conflict between them. The other issue in this convoluted fact situation is whether or not the CFI ever gave any consideration to whether there would be a less impactful resolution in terms of maybe some counseling, maybe some direction towards mom as to what she needed to do to preserve her relationship with the child. Nothing of those matters were discussed, and at the, in the trial.
Counsel, let me ask you, if I can interrupt, what issue does this go to? Are you arguing sufficiency of the evidence? Are you arguing the CFI should not have been permitted to testify? Or you put on an expert yourself to say why the CFI messed up in all these various ways, but what issue does it go to?
Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, if you're hiring your own expert, you have all the guidelines that you have to follow under 127. When a CFI is appointed, nobody's really scrutinizing that person's expertise in the context of the case. It's kind of like the lawyers get together and say, okay, who are we going to hire? Jane Doe sounds good. She's a lawyer. I know she's done a lot of CFIs. Let's go. Then you have this scenario unravel, and you find out that the issues are more important and more complex than just deciding who should have more parenting time or the other. And so then it's up to the CFI, in my view, to say, whoa, wait a minute. This is beyond me. I'm a lawyer. In this particular case, the CFI was a lawyer. I'm a lawyer. I don't have training. I don't have clinical experience. I don't have training in child development beyond some cursory college course. I don't know that I'm competent to do this. And I think it's up to, especially a lawyer CFI, it's up to that person to go back to the trial court and say, Judge, this needs more.
So what's the legal hook? Is it that the judge abused his discretion by relying on the CFI who didn't do these things?
In my view, it's 702.
All right, but did you ever object?
702.
Okay, but did you ever object on 702 grounds?
No, we did not object on 702 grounds. We objected to the whole report.
All right, but you just told me that the issue is 702. Why is that before us if you didn't object? How did we get to that issue?
I was on trial counsel at the time.
that was the generic you. I'm sorry.
But I don't care.
Okay.
Because what I'm saying to you is I think it was plain error, in my view, for the judicial officer to continue once there was an expert saying, look, I'm pointing out to you, I'm an expert in the field. I'm pointing out to you, Judge, that this was deficient in this case. And what you have here is you have an unprotected child. Child didn't have a lawyer here, right? It's the lawyers of the parents that worked out this deal. And this was a lousy deal. Excuse my characterization, but it was not a good deal. And if in the brief, I think on the last section, it itemizes how this was a ram job on the client. I mean, the mediation order said 10 days before trial, have mediation completed. These people go in on the night before trial, 8 hours of mediation. The lawyers are scrambling to comport with the court order. They don't want to look bad in front of the judge for not having complied with the mediation order. So they come up with this memorandum of understanding. And the memorandum of understanding incorporates in it a condition that is contrary to our two-year limitation and says, okay, you can come back in 1 year and we'll see how things are going out in Iowa. Well, the pressure under the facts of this particular case on mom are phenomenal. And she's being told all kinds of things. She wants to do what she thinks is the right thing for her daughter, but she doesn't want to lose her daughter. And so in the context of all of this, she ultimately says, I don't want to do what the MOU is saying. She checks with another lawyer. The other lawyer reviews the reports of the CFI and say, this is ridiculous. You can stand up and object to this. And so that's what she did. She basically asserted her right to say, no, that's not what I want to do.
If I can just ask you to step back on the MOU issue, a procedural question. What is the order that's being appealed here? I'm a little puzzled by what exactly was being presented to the court. It was the issue, the court obviously said I enforced the MOU, or was the judge ruling on dad's motion to modify the parental responsibility? I'm very puzzled by what issue is before us. Did you understand my question? I had trouble getting it out.
Well, the first issue is the enforcement of the MOU under the circumstances that it was entered into under it. My client, in my view, it was done under duress.
Okay. And in your view, is that what the court ruled on? Did the court also rule on father's petition to modify?
The court did not rule on the court just enforced the MOU.
Okay, that's what I was asking, thank you.
The second issue that we're appealing and it's an invitation to this court to deal with this CFI statute in some sort of rational way so that there's some parameters as to what the courts are going to order in the future under the CFI statute. Because that statute was born out of an urgency to have somebody assist the courts in the remote areas of Colorado with coming to some decisions regarding what would help the parents in parenting situations. In fact, what happened is it's being applied across the board, and people who are either qualified or not qualified can take up the mantle of CFI and render opinions when they may or may not have the expertise to do it. Normally, the risks are not that high. If we're talking about, you know, what are you going to have Mondays, Wednesdays, or Fridays, alternating weekend, you know, all that can reasonably be done by somebody that has experience. But when you're talking about relocating a child with minimal investigation and moving that child 900 miles away, and the result of that increasing the conflictual relationship between the parents, which was never even discussed, thought about, ventured into by the CFI in this case, I think we have a real problem. And I think there needs to be some fine tuning as to what is required of the CFIs. And I would suggest to the court that what makes a lot of sense is the traditional custody statute, which was 127, which is still in effect. They changed the names, but the guidance that it gives the court in terms of who is qualified mentions only mental health professionals. It does not allow anybody who has some experience with children and with parenting time schedules to render these important decisions. And I would ask the court to consider that in fashioning its order in this particular case and have some guidelines as to what happens if a CFI is a lawyer and whether or not that's acceptable to the court. And I'd like to reserve a few minutes.
Certainly.
I'm not sure this podium's ever been this high.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Michael Grills. My registration number is 19785. I am counsel for the respondent appellee, Randy Hartwig, in this matter. Unlike Mr. Wimmershoff, I was trial counsel for the respondent in a matter that's before this court today. Whether that qualifies me to be better at understanding what's at issue or arguing those things, I guess that'll be left to you folks' judgment. I wanted to address the question that Judge Gabriel asked Mr. Wimmershoff about, the nature and the breadth of the trial court's ruling. I think the trial court did both. Addressed both the memorandum, the viability, the enforceability of the memorandum of understanding, and in addition to that, made specific findings of endangerment, best interests, and benefit offsetting detriment to the child by the proposed move.
This may be unfair to you, Mr. Grills, and if it is, you can feel free to tell me that. But can you show me where? I comb the record for this. The court does make a comment on endangerment in the transcript. It's pages 107 to 108. I don't even know if you have it.
I don't, sir.
Let me kind of generally point you, and then you could tell me if there's someplace else I should look.
Okay.
The judge said, and actually, you know, I don't know, I guess I'll find by preponderance of the evidence, that if in the alternative, if the standard is endangerment, then I do have some information about that. And then the judge goes on and talks about everything that the CFI talked about. The judge never specifically says, I find endangerment. He just kind of points out there was some evidence.
Okay.
I don't see a finding on endangerment, nor on changed circumstances, which is of concern to me because the statute points that out. Now, I'm not trying to catch you here.
No,
is there someplace else in the record, or is that what you're thinking of?
You know, that's what I was thinking of, Judge, and candidly, I think I would be anything less than candid to this court if I told you that I was aware of some other portion of the...
Counsel, did you understand that to be a finding of endangerment?
What was that, Judge?
Did you understand the court's that statement to be essentially a finding that the endangerment standard had been met?
Yes, sir, I did.
And let me ask you about the memorandum of understanding. What is it significant apart from your motion to modify parenting time? Does it have independent legal significance?
And Your Honor, could I ask you to clarify what you mean when you say that?
Well, I mean, you indicated to Judge Gabriel that you thought the court's order addressed both the motion to modify and the enforceability of the memorandum of understanding. But doesn't the memorandum of understanding merely
summarize what
and liquidate the concerns that were presented in the motion to modify?
I would agree with that, given what transpired procedurally, both prior to the scheduled hearing in early June, and then subsequent to that. You know, candidly, I think that both my focus of petitioner's counsel, and probably ultimately the focus of the trial court related to the memorandum of understanding, the provisions in that, and specifically the provisions related to the change in residence and the schedule and the like.
Counsel, I guess here is how my impression, of course, we just read a cold record, and maybe you can enlighten me. My sense was this was almost like a motion to enforce a settlement agreement. That's really what the focus of the hearing was. And sometimes you'll have a dispute on a contract, say. Parties think they settled it, they go to mediation, somebody allegedly reneges, and they have a fight over whether to enforce the settlement agreement, and you never end up talking about the merits of the dispute. My impression, which could be dead wrong, was that that's really what this hearing was about, focusing on whether to enforce the MOU as a settlement among the parties of their dispute.
Well, I can certainly tell the court that there was a motion that I filed that was after it became apparent that the petitioner was dissatisfied with and not willing to go forward with, in some fashion was objecting to the terms of the memorandum of understanding. I guess what I would say is that, that certainly was an issue that was out there, whether ultimately the court specifically couched its findings and conclusions based in terms of enforcement, enforcing that, candidly, I probably was not the case.
I'm sorry, what was not the case?
It did not couch its findings of fact and conclusions of law as a response to or a... Or addressing specifically the motion that I had filed for enforcement of the memorandum of understanding.
So you're saying the court didn't do that or did?
I'm saying I don't think it did, Judge. I think what it did was it went beyond that, given the issues that were raised by petitioner regarding duress, apparently the scope of the investigation and the conclusions reached by the CFI, things of that nature. One thing I think it's important for this court to be aware of with respect to these concerns raised on appeal with respect to, you know, the CFI, is that these weren't issues that were raised at the trial court. There was never any, discussion or objection or argument at the trial court level about the qualifications of the CFI to provide the, you know, the observations, the investigation that she did, and the conclusions that she. So, you know, while I certainly appreciate Mr. Wimmershoff's interest in trying to rewrite the CFI statute, that was not an argument that was raised at the trial court level, and I don't think it's appropriate to be addressed at this point. And even, let's say for sake of our discussion today, that is the case, I'm not aware of anything in terms of legislative history or legislative intent that should cause this court to rewrite that statute along the lines of what's being suggested.
Counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Could I ask you to stay near the microphone?
I beg your pardon. It's, in any event, Petitioner's counsel is asking, you know, that the court rewrite the CFI statute essentially to say that, you know, in order for a trial court to make a finding of endangerment, it has to rely on some sort of expert testimony. For one thing, that's completely impractical. There is no law, there is no authority for that proposition. If the court were to rule in that fashion, that's going to put a lot of folks in Adams County, down in Otero County, who reasonably can't afford to have, you know, to spend money on some sort of expert witness to provide that sort of information. The trial court is not bound by the recommendations made by a child and family investigator. It is certainly, you know, allowed to give it as much weight as it reasonably wants to when it's making its determinations about endangerment, best interests of the child, and whether the change in residence, benefits from the change of residence would be offset by, would offset any detriments to the child. I want to address the Johnson case that's raised in the briefs in this case. I think what's important for the court to understand with respect to Johnson has been raised in my answer, but I would highlight a couple of things. Number one, to the extent that Johnson is applicable to the case before this court, Johnson doesn't say that if you have, a provision of the sort that's at issue here, that you have to strike the entirety of the agreement. I think the remedy or the result from Johnson should simply be that, in the event that hasn't happened yet, that someone seeks to have that provision be enforceable, the court simply can't do that, and instead has to apply the statute. That's appropriate. I think that's the remedy if and when there was ever a motion filed in this case for a change in the child's primary residence.
Counsel, let me ask you a question about that. Assuming for the sake of argument that the court's order here depends on, is predicated on the validity of the memorandum of understanding, would that remedy be possible if the voluntariness of mother's agreement depends in part on that provision? In other words, doesn't that vitiate the legitimacy of the agreement?
At least based on the application of Johnson, I don't think it does. I've looked at Johnson, I've looked at other cases that have
follow Johnson. And it's my impression, based on my reading of those cases. Let's take Johnson, for example. That, as I'm sure the court's aware, that was a case where the parties entered into a separation agreement that included a provision that changed the statutory standard for a change in the child's primary residence. And what the court in Johnson did was not simply say, well, we're going to have to just strike vitiate or strike the entirety of that agreement. Johnson simply says, and I think the cases that have followed Johnson since have said that, we simply can't enforce that piece of this provision. I think that's a fair statement of the laws that exist in this state at this point. I think there are a couple of things. I'm not going to take up much more time. I'm going to stand on my arguments as set out in my answer brief with respect to the continuance allegation. This is part of this that's tough for me to do is, to ask for, relief in the way of sanctions. I think that from where I sit, this is a case that has been, this is an appeal that has been replete with issues that weren't raised at the trial court level. Or if you examined the record, it's clear that they're non-issues. The best one being the continuance request. It's spelled out, it's this argument about petitioner being denied some measure of due process because she wasn't allowed a continuance, that was specifically waived at trial. Her trial counsel said, if Dr. Fife can testify, we will withdraw that request for a continuance. Why that's being raised now, why that's ever had to be addressed by this court is, it's a mystery to me. And, I certainly appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I'm sorry that I am having to be here today to address this stuff. Frankly, I think a lot of what has been raised as issues in this case should never have been appealed. I would ask the court to not only affirm the ruling of the trial court, but enter appropriate sanctions as it's authorized to do under appropriate statute and rule.
Mr. Mills, before you leave, one more question. On the procedural issue, I'm sure you can tell it bothers me. You may remember the court issued a written order after the hearing. It's a one-pager. Did the court ask you to submit the order? In other words, did you draft it or did the court? Do you remember?
I'm pretty sure I did, sir.
All right, and this maybe if this refreshes your recollection as to what was at issue, the first sentence says, this matter came before the court for hearing on July 19 and 20, 2007, regarding whether the party's memorandum of understanding for mediation on June 11 should be adopted as an order of the court.
Okay.
Maybe that's where I'm getting, and you said the opposite, that it wasn't your sense of the focus. Does that help you? Does that change your view?
Well, Judge, if I drafted the motion, if I drafted the order and that's what it says, I think I would be disingenuous right now if I told you something different.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Let me add a follow-up question then, counsel. Let's assume for the sake of argument that there was no disagreement, that the parties agreed to go along with the memorandum of understanding. Could they have affected a change in residence on that alone, is this a kind of situation that because the court must act to protect the best interest of the child, the court must approve in any event?
Well, I think the law is clear. The trial courts in this case always have jurisdiction, and not just jurisdiction. I think they have an affirmative duty to review whatever agreement is reached between parties, and make findings that it's appropriate in the child's best interest. I don't think just something written up between these folks, without some sort of judicial scrutiny or review would be appropriate.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Your Honors, I'd like to address a few issues raised by counsel. Just a second. With regard to the issues not being raised at the trial court level, I would disagree with that. The whole idea of the hearing was to reject the CFI's report. That's why we had an expert there. That's why we were arguing that we didn't like the report and we didn't want the court to rely on it. And I think the case is Melendez that says you don't have to use talismanic language to preserve particular arguments for appeal. So I'm going to rely on that case and say our whole presentation, or the whole presentation at the trial court level, was an objection to the CFI report and to the recommendation that the child leave the state.
Counsel, but just to be clear, one of the arguments you made was not that the CFI was unqualified to render an opinion in this case.
No, that particular issue was not raised specifically. However, that was the point of having the expert. So to be abundantly clear, it was in the air. It just, no one stood up and said, we object to the CFI as not being an expert. But I think that's a question of law that you can look at de novo right now without it being raised. And I've read enough Court of Appeals opinions to know you can really do what you want with this case. Either you're going to go and deal with the issue and say, you know, this is too important of an issue for us to just let slide, or you're going to say it wasn't specifically mentioned and you didn't preserve it well enough at the trial court level. I mean, I would just beg the court to consider the particular CFI issue in this case. I think is extremely important. It's a matter of public protection and guidance to the courts as to what's acceptable and what's not acceptable in CFI world. And I just would refer back strongly to 1410.127, which in subparagraph 4 says, a person shall not be allowed to testify regarding the parental responsibilities unless, and they talk about all the parameters. There's like six parameters that the person has to have in order to render an opinion.
But that's not the CFI statute, counsel. The CFI statute, that's 1410.116.5.
I'm aware of that, Your Honor, and not to, that's my point. Is there something wrong with the CFI statute because it doesn't provide enough guidelines for witnesses who are going to make such a monumental decision, important decision, as removing a child from the primary caretaker, in this case for 8 years, with minimal investigation, and all of this is in the record, minimal investigation, and say that child's going to Iowa. It's just wrong. And on the icing on the cake is, on page 27 of my brief, that the CFI, I mean the time factors, if you look at those, the CFI report is received on May 31st, the CFI supplemental report is on June 4th, the mediation is held on June 11th, the trial date is on June 12th, and this is the context in which this CFI report was developed. And as
counsel,
one side note,
your time has expired.
Thank you.
Thank you. Court thanks both counsel for their arguments. This case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.
Thank you, sir.
Court will now call the case of Summit Park 2 Owners Association against Summit Park Condominium Association.